new docking towers, docking adapters that they'll be bringing up. They'll be bringing one up this month. And not on the next flight. Next flight, they're going to, Falcon 9 is going to launch in the trunk of the Dragon beam. They call it the beam. That's a Bigelow expandable module that's going to be attached to the International Space Station for a couple of years. But the flight after that, they're going to bring up the second docking module, NASA docking adapter, to the space station. So they'll have to have space flights to space EVAs to attach these things. So that'll be coming up. So they brought back Terry Burtz and Samantha Christopher Eddy from the Italian Space Agency, flying for the European Space Agency. She was up in it for about 200 days as well. First time up, and actually she was one of the hands on board that operated from the space station. So she's back. She's the one that you sent me a video, Dick, about the cupola. And she was demonstrating how it opened and closed. Very interesting, by the way. I've never seen it actually in operation. I know they had linkages going through, but interesting to actually see one of these covers close on the outdoor windows. Sometimes they need to close them, and that they're able to do that with these control rods. You turn them and you can close these six outdoor doors, and actually seven doors, but the middle one is because the round one, if need be. So good video, Dick, that you sent. Let me drop it. Now, I have quite a bit more here, Dick. I guess we'll probably run out of time. I just wanted to mention that the Discover spacecraft for NOAA, the weather, space weather satellite has reached its destination. This is the one that launched about 4 months ago on a SpaceX Falcon 9. No Dragon attached. It was actually a spacecraft, and it went out to the L1 position and successfully made it there after 4 months. It does take that long to get there, so it's only 1 million miles away. And it's now in what they call a halo orbit, located between the Sun and Earth. And it's going to be taking measurements of the Sun and also actually pictures and measurements of the Earth at 1 million miles out. First, weather satellite will be looking at the Earth, stationed at the 1 million L1 location. At the L2 location, another spacecraft we talked about a couple of years, Gaia, is now going to be put into operation. Gaia is a spacecraft built by the European Space Agency that is going to be looking for. One of the things that they're going to look for that I'm interested in is exoplanets, but it's going to be doing a lot of other science as well. There's a telescope that was put out at the L2 position. It's a million miles past the Earth. And although it got out there, you know, soon after it was launched, back in December of 2013, it was supposed to have a three-month shakedown period. They realized it was getting stray light in there, and it's taken all this time to to eventually correct that problem. But now they're going to finally put it into operation. Here we are in the middle of June, and it should have a five-year mission. The Discover that I mentioned before is also a planned two-year mission, but they have plenty of fuel on board for a five-year mission for that as well. So there's more things here, but we'll just let them fly for now, Dick. Maybe pick it up next week. Back to you or anybody else for any questions. This is WS2N. I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com or my call letter is at arrl.net. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N.
Very fine, Paul. One quick question. Your second web address at arrl.net. your call letters, WS2N at ERRail.net. How long have you had that one, Paul? Was that available a year ago, for instance?
No, I've had that, like, you know, forever. Whenever the ARRL came out with whatever email you had. In this case, it was linked to the library. I think you had, like I mentioned last week, I think you were signed up at the library, and you told me at one time, Suffolk Web. Now they're closing that down, so if you have anything valuable, find that email. You got to get it out before December. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I don't know if I can have the ability to store things there. I don't store things there. And I used to be using SuffolkNet as one of my email addresses. And I know that it's about to discontinue. I've been telling people that one. My real email address is my call letters at arrl.net, among others. This report that I'm seeing in Electronic Component News for Friday, June the 12th, which I think is the day that they return, it said that Samantha Cristoforetti, the Italian female astronaut, cosmonaut, it said 199 days. I bet you it's 199 and a fraction, very close to 200. But it said that because of the delay return, Cristoforetti, an Italian, has now spent more continuous time in space than any other woman, surpassing by several days the mark set by a NASA astronaut in 2007. So she's the lady with the longest amount of time in space. And spending that much time, essentially 200 days in weightlessness, when you come back to gravity, I guarantee gravity must feel very strange. And they have them in these reclining couches as soon as they remove them from the spacecraft. And I bet you they're not able to walk for quite a period of time. Any idea, Paul, have you ever heard how long it takes for them to restore the balance in their ears and be able to walk again? And also, you've got to rebuild those muscles. And there's bone loss, muscle loss, all kinds of things happen in space. So have you ever read anything as to how long it takes before they're able to walk without assistance after returning from long space flights? WS2N, K2RIW.
You know, they can't drive a car, like, for about a month or so. It's the dizzying effect that they have. So you won't see them driving around. It does take a long time. I remember listening to Mark Kelly, not Scott Kelly. Scott Kelly's up there now. His twin brother was talking about it one time. He said that a lot of times it takes a long time. If you're up there for 3 months, it takes 3 months before you feel right. If you're up there for a week, you know, you go on a quick shuttle mission, same thing, about a week. So that's the deal on that. And then, they said 200 days. What I read, just, I don't know, because they land in Kazakhstan, it's only 4 or 5 hours after they leave the space station. So Cristoforetti, she beat out Sunita Williams, Sunita Nicola. She was up to the space station quite a few times, and eventually she was a commander on the space station. And if you ever bring up Sunita Williams' name, put in International Space Station, or ISS, tour. You know, a lot of the astronauts have given tours of these space station. I think she had the best one when she was up there. Fantastic. So did you ever see how they get them out of the Soyuz spacecraft? Did you ever see the act on how they do that?
Go right ahead and give us that description. No, I haven't seen that one. And one other thing I wanted to mention is that the seven windows of the cupola, six in the perimeter and one in the center, this handle you've got, and there's seven of those handles. You turn this knob, and it's got a shaft with two O-rings on it to make sure the air doesn't leak out, and it operates a worm drive-like mechanism that lowers this fairly sturdy shade, a very sturdy cup-shaped device over each one of those windows. And the main reason they do that is to make sure the windows don't pick up hot marks. On each one of the space shuttles after a landing, they do a microscopic examination of all the windows, and they find a whole lot of little bitty pockmarks of where micrometeorites have hit the window of the space shuttle. And so they study that after each mission. That's what they used to do on the space shuttle. So the same thing would be happening with the cupola. And after a whole lot of time in space, you wouldn't get quite as clear a picture through that cupola because the windows are becoming pockmarked. So those shades are supposed to shield those windows and maybe even to keep the cupola cool during the rest of the time when you're not not using it to make fancy photography. So describe what it's like to remove them from the Soyuz spacecraft. And I guess you don't just grab an arm and yank them out. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, and I noticed Samantha Chris Moretti was turning that dial to that linkage. You turn it, you don't pull it or push it, you turn it. You can see there, this trapezoidal window closing. You know, there's six trapezoidal windows. And you can see it closing, and then even as she let go, that thing was still moving, so it must be some kind of a gear on there or something. It looked like it kept moving as she wasn't even touching it. I thought that was kind of strange. Some kind of worm type of gear, probably. When they land, and you know, they land in all kinds of weather over there. I saw one where they land in the snow. Soyuz craft naturally comes down on a heat shield. Actually has rocket jets that go off at the last second to try to, even though it comes down with a parachute, to try to soften the blow. But they say it's hard land. It feels like you're in a car wreck. That's the way it's been described. When they come out there, they know about where they are, and they come flying out there with all this big heavy-duty equipment. And on one of the transports, they take out this thing. It looks like a gigantic something you would set up for the kids in a playground. It's a bunch of tubing, and they place it over. You know, it's got legs that go all the way down to the ground. They place it over over the whole spacecraft. So there's like a little ladder, metal ladder that you climb up, and on the top is this big hole. Don't have to be that big because the diameter of any docking mechanism for the rush is 31 inches in diameter. So it gives you an idea of how big the hole is on top. And they open the spacecraft, that door, they pull that inward, and they actually stand up and they pull them up arm in arm until they get them to the top, and then down one of the ramps that they have when you're up on top is this slide. I mean, it looks like a kid's slide. That's right. I tell you, it looks like something you would put in a kid's playground. So they come out with a helmet and all, and slide down this thing, and then they carry him away, and they put him in a call it a lounge chair, some sort of blanket, you know, and then the doctors get a hold of him, and they talk to them, and they get on the phone, and they hang out there for a while before they bring him back. But this gadget they put up in a spacecraft is incredible. Incredible. I've been done it a couple of times, Dick. Back to you.
You make it sound like it's almost a crane mechanism that lifts them out onto that slide and then slides them down. There's a mechanical advantage in the frame and the mechanism that actually lifts them out of the Soyuz. And by the way, this article also said they had a soft landing. I'm not looking that down. Yeah, touchdown softly. After descending slowly under a striped red and white parachute, the craft touched down softly on the sun-drenched step. Russian helicopters quickly delivered search and rescue crews to help the astronauts get out of the capsule and quickly check their condition. So when you're landing on hard land with a parachute, and they said they landed softly, it sounds like a bit of an exaggeration. Well, if you're long distance away watching it land, it may look like soft landing. But to hit on hard dirt, as opposed to landing in the ocean like the American astronauts do, I think you're more accurate when you say it's a little bit like an automobile crash. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I'm trying to think of which astronaut said that. And, it's a pretty rough landing. But they have these rockets that go off at the last second, but, you know, they should perfect that a little bit, I guess. You know, just right before they land, they go off and really try to soften the landing. Hopefully they're getting better at it. I mean, they've done this so many times. It's about four times a year they come in for landings in Kazakhstan. You know, there's no mechanism. I mean, there's two guys up on top, and they pull them out, you know? I mean, it's really an Armstrong type of thing. And then once they get them up, you know, the astronauts helping themselves, you know, they're not dead weight, you know, they're pulling themselves out too. But they get up on top, and they slide down this thing, and they just guide them down this little slide. That's how they do it. So I don't see any kind of mechanism. I guess if somebody was injured, they'd have to do something. There must be some kind of plan B. I haven't seen that. Back.
If you had the opportunity, would you take one of these trips up, Paul? You've studied space now for a whole lot of years. If you had the opportunity, would you go?
I might have signed up, you know, and gone to Star City and practiced and got ready. And I think I would have been more like Sarah Brightman, you know. She's that one that changed her mind. And she changed her mind right before they had problems with the Progress going up. Progress and Soyuz kind of looked the same, and they're launched by the same rocket, Soyuz rocket. And I think she was thinking twice about it. And, you know, she's probably looking at the Americans, you know, what we're doing with the Crew Dragon spacecraft, and eventually the Boeing CST-100 and a couple of the other companies that are involved with future spaceflight. And I think she might have said to herself, you know, I'm gonna go ride up to the Bigelow Space Station when that's built in a couple of years. And I probably would do the same thing. But of course now I'm older. No, I don't think so. Couldn't even get me to go to Russia. The shuttle was good in the beginning, but that started going downhill with all the problems they had. Back to you, Dick, WS-20.
In my younger days, maybe, but I'm not so sure I would go now. You talked about the spacecraft that went to the Lagrange point number one. That's the point a million miles away from the Earth toward the sun. And we've got a number of spacecraft at Lagrange point number two, a million miles away from the Earth in the opposite direction. SOHO, Solar Observatory, I think it's called the SOHO. And I think there was a pair of them that we put up altogether. Do you happen to know roughly the number of spacecraft that we have launched to Lagrange point number one and approximately the number we've launched to Lagrange point number two? The Webb Space Telescope 2018 is going to go to Lagrange point number two. And part of why I'm asking this question is that as you start putting a whole lot of spacecraft in each of these areas, you got to worry about them hitting each other. And by the way, Lagrange point number one and number two are only partially stable. They're not completely stable. If something went wrong and they drift far away from the neutral gravity point, they could drift away. They're a semi-stable point. So I guess they've chosen some kind of a slightly elliptical orbit, so to speak, in that location. Does it almost automatically maintain its position, or does it take some positioning? Stations happen to know rough guess of full WS2N, K2LAW?
Trying to remember the weight. I think the weight was close to 2,000 pounds for Discover, about it. L1, and roughly half of it is fuel, and they got enough fuel for 5 years to stay in what they call a halo orbit, and which is, it's really that same position, but they keep rotating around this one area. So you might come back, a week from now and find that spacecraft's in a different position. And then, you'll see that the 12 o'clock position, the 9 o'clock position, back to 6, back to 3, it just stays in this halo type of location, but, sometimes hundreds of thousands of miles apart. I mean, it's far from anything else, when anything else is out there. So at L1, the only ones I know are SOHO, like you mentioned, and ACE. ACE is getting old. That's been out there like, 20 years, 17 years or something. And that's been doing a lot of solar work. If solar storm comes, that thing will let us know that, it's getting hit by, protons, electrons flying off the sun. And Discover's going to do the same thing, especially if ACE eventually quits. So you have that at L1. I'm trying to remember if there was anything else over there. Don't remember. L2, you have now Gaia, and eventually the James Webb Space Telescope. You had Herschel out there, launched by an Ariane rocket, and also the Planck telescope, and that was also launched by the same Ariane rocket. They were one on top of one another, and they were launched, and they're out there at L2. We don't have anything at L3. That's a shame. I'd like to put one in just for last. You do have two spacecraft, the stereo spacecraft, which are one is going behind the Earth, and the other one is going forward of the Earth in our orbit all the way around the sun. You have that, and they're interesting spacecraft. Back to you, Dick.
It doesn't sound like they worry very much about things at L1 or L2 hitting each other, and I think you said that Discover has close to a ton of fuel that implies that a lot of station keeping is required, or did I misunderstand that? I think you said there's almost a ton of fuel on Discover. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I think it weighs, I forgot, I have to look it up. I think it's 1,800 pounds or something. And then it's half of that was fuel to get out there. Not that they needed that much to get out there. It took 4 months to get there. The second stage, the Merlin one, pretty much took care of that from SpaceX. When they launch a spacecraft to the L1 position, it takes 4 months. You say, how come that happens? You got the moon, you get to the moon in 4 days. Well, when you go out to L1, it's only, four times further than the moon. It's taking 4 months to get there for. Because when they launch it, they just launch it with enough power. And it's starting out, sure, 20,000 miles an hour, whatever it is, to break out of Earth orbit. I think Earth orbit is 25,000 miles an hour. So it gets out of that, out of the Earth well, but not entirely. The Earth is still pulling on it, and the sun is eventually going to be pulling on it. So it goes out further and further, but it slows down, and now it's all of a sudden, a month from now, it's down to, down to the miles per hour. Another month goes by, down to, 1,000 miles an hour, and the next thing you know, 4 months goes by, and you get down to zero. That's how they get it there. Back to you, there.
Yes, I can see how that happens. They're literally throwing it to the altitude where it will stop. when you get to that point of equal gravity from Sun and Earth at Lagrange point number one, which is roughly 1,000 miles away from the Earth toward the Sun, you don't want to reach that point with an extra 500 miles an hour and just drip right through that point and go falling toward the Sun. You got to very gently come up to that point at nearly zero speed. I can see how that is a slow process. And I am guessing going to Lagrange point number two is also a little slow, but maybe not quite that slow. I think he told me that going to Lagrange point number two, you get there a little bit sooner. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yes, Guy, I got there in a month. Discover has... They have a lot of testing to do with that spacecraft, too. So now that it's there, you're not going to get signs. You're not going to see pictures of the Earth yet, you know. That's what I want to see. You know, but it turns out you've got another 3 months for what are you, what's the word they use? Commissioning. They call it commissioning. Another 3 months for commissioning to discover. And then the science will start. Back to there.
And probably the same length of time will take to launch James Webb and also to commission it to do a full test and checkout. Boy, that's going to be a long deployment. It's got a whole lot of things that are going to unfold. Everything's got to go just right. All those explosive bolts have to take off, have to do their thing at just the right time. Boy, there's only 100 things that can go wrong in that whole deployment process. And if any one of them does go wrong, there's essentially no backup. You can't send an astronaut out there like Story Musgrave, where he did this great big repair mission on the Hubble Space Telescope. You can't do that with James Webb. No way in hell can you get a human being out there 100 miles and bring him back. You can't give him enough consumables to last for that long and to be exposed to all the bad stuff in space for that long is not good. And I'm a little disappointed that you and I are not hearing more stories about remotely controlled or remotely piloted vehicles, robots, to go out and refuel these things and do repairs. I didn't say it's easy. You can send a machine, though, to a lot of places where you'll never send a human being. You heard me say so often. Let me drop the phone. It is my strong belief that the grandchildren of the people within the sound of my voice right now, your grandchildren, are not going to see a human being standing on Mars. Much too expensive, much too dangerous, and nowhere near cost-effective. It would take the resources of multiple nations being pooled together to afford to do that. And each one of those nations are going to say, what do I get in return? Why do I want to send a man there when I've got Spirit, Opportunity, I've got Curiosity, and then there'll be a new replacement for Curiosity. I mean, to send an unmanned spacecraft there and to get data from it for years on end, as opposed to sending a human being where his chances of surviving are very poor and the chances of getting him back home again are almost zero. And that's not a mission I would volunteer for, even though we know there's a very high-performance senior or freshman college student on Long Island who has volunteered to go to Mars. But people have signed up to volunteer. I'm not sure they know all the details. Let me drop them.
They should listen to this net.
Yeah, it would get some discouragement. And even a guy who is as well acquainted with the space program as Buzz Aldrin, the second man to step onto the moon, he is very disappointed that we're not sending a group of people back to the moon to colonize the moon. Very disappointed about that. I've seen interviews of him where he's got this disappointment. And so in the process of him doing all of this practice he had to do to successfully carry out the Apollo 11 mission, he never was informed about what was going on in the back room. Some very careful calculations took place as to where you land on the moon, because the moon has a day that is 27 Earth days long. High noon on the Earth, you could say, lasts from 11 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Those 2 hours, okay? On the moon, high noon lasts for 27 times longer. So it's high noon on the moon lasts for 57 hours. In 57 hours, boy, can that place get hot, like 170 degrees Fahrenheit. There's not enough air conditioning in the world that'll protect you in that environment. And then the nighttime, midnight hour, also lasts for 57 hours. The midnight, if you know what I mean, the 12 o'clock midnight, and there's when the temperature gets down to minus 270 degrees Fahrenheit. These are way beyond survivable temperatures. So you don't want to put a colony there unless that colony is 20 meters below the surface where the temperature is more constant. Okay, by what means do you establish that habitat down there? We've just about run out of time. Yep, we got about 1 minute left.
Repeater, timeout.
Next week I'll read you this report about what's going on at Stanford University. Oh, correction, Berkeley, California, where they're all up in arms about the danger of cell phones. And somebody got so angry reading about this, told them the best way to solve the problem is to turn off all the cell sites that are within range of Berkeley. The pop will go away. They'll have a whole lot of brand new problems. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1560. And you've heard Space Report number 153. We'll be back next week, we think, as long as we collect more information about all these crazy subjects. I'm going to turn it over to John to get his final comments. KC2WGB, the co-host, K2RIW. You got it, John.
Zach, I just finished reading Buzz Aldrin's latest book, Mission to Mars, pushing Mars now, big time. He keeps giving up with the moon. John, over to you.
Very good, gentlemen. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us this week, and I'll give my email in case anybody has questions for the TechNet they'd like me to pose. You can get that email to me at julianbravo5@aol.com. julianbravo5@aol.com. Good night, be well, and have fun. Gentlemen, au revoir. KC2WGB.
And as a last question, John, how's Cookie doing? Is she complaining a little bit about her aches and pains of any of her bones? Over to you, John.
Well, the last 3 days, she's been doing very well. She's been getting up and moving around, so a little life came back to her. So, doing well, best as she can do. She's going to be 14 soon, so, you know, that's getting near the limit. But thanks for asking. Be well. KC2WGB.
If a dog's life is like 7 to 1 to human life, and I multiply 7 times 14, does that mean she's around 100 years old, equivalent, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what they say, 7 to 1. So, yeah, that's a good run. And they sure do spend a lot of energy as pups, but, you know, when they get older, you know, they get that... She's like a cow now. She goes out and grazes and lays down.
7 times 14 is age 98. So she's a 98-year-old dog. And I think she's like, if I remember you describing to me, almost an Alaskan Husky type dog. Go ahead.
Swiss Mountain Dog. Yeah, she's mostly black with some brown and white marks on her. And a fair-sized dog. She's lost a lot of weight now. She's around 70 pounds, but she used to be pushing like 90. She's a beefy dog.
Wow. Roughly how many pounds of food per day in her younger days was she consuming, John?
She would eat two large cans of dog food, or maybe one can of dog and one shovel of dried food. But that's about all she ate. A good-sized bowl. But she drinks a lot of water.
The same with my cats. I got two cats, and I think they drink, a pound and a half of water per day. Rough guess, John, go ahead.
Bristol, she drinks 2 liters a day.
I think that's more than many humans do. Okay, John. Bye-bye. And bye bye to Cookie.
Good night, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Have fun, guys. KC2WGB clear.
Do I see it?
1:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system.
N2PPN, N2ZEP. N2ZEP. N2PPN, N2ZEP, good morning, Rich.
Got your new microphone cord all installed on your mobile rig?
Yes, I do.
And I as well.
Did you find as you closed the microphone back up, you had to wait until the rubber or whatever it is on the new mic cord gave a little bit before we would close?
Yes, I did.
But eventually it closed down to fully closed.
Yes.
That door mount for my HT didn't work out perfectly, but I got it hooked up.
Okay. Sounds like a dealio.
I don't know if that'll end up being the permanent location, but the other location that would be good for it would include Velcro, but it would bury the antenna too far down in the car.
Don't want to do that. Gotta keep that antenna up near the window, unless you're gonna go for a external antenna hookup.
I know. The most convenient spot for the radio is actually to be Velcroed to my emergency brake handle.
All right, that would work. But then, like I said, then having a external antenna would definitely make a difference.
Yep. That's why I'm trying this first. If this works, it's a good position. You just have to remember the order that the frequencies are put in on. Right now, I'm on this station, this club's frequency, and one click of the red brings me over to that other frequency.
And that should be easy to remember.
Yep, this way I don't even have to look at the screen.
As do I with the radios that have no display on them at all. I have to remember how many clicks from channel 1 to go to different channels. So I have to do that, which is why having a radio with a display on the motorcycle will make life a little simpler.
Well, hopefully you have all your radios set up in the exact same order, so you don't have to worry about that.
The Motorolas are all set up, and plus the Motorolas have cheat sheets on them. I print out the channel assignments from the program, and then I tape them to the front of the radio, so if you're really in a pickle, you just have to look at the cheat sheet that tells you, what channel to dial up. NCPM Mobile.
N2ZEP Mobile in the four-laner. All right. So, got a question. This is, if I am, and this is probably how you and Steve talk back and forth Florida. If he's down in Florida and he hits the North American funk group, and you're up here and you hit the North American funk group, you're technically hooked to different repeaters, but through the magic of DMR, you're talking on the same group?
Provided that all of the repeaters are on the same network, because there are a couple of different networks, and that all are up and connected. See, right now, club repeater is not fully connected. So, I don't believe North America, worldwide, all those groups are active. So even though you might be able to transmit on it, they're not active because they're not going out into the world. But yes, that's how it works. So if he's down there and he's on North America and you're on North America up here, yep. That, in that way, it's much like IRLP, where you're connected to a reflector and then everything that goes on this repeater goes on another repeater someplace else that's also connected to the reflector. So in that way, that it's much like IRLP.
So from that point of view, when everything is fully hooked up, if there is a common talk group between the two repeaters that we use, we could talk all the way, just switch between those two talk groups, stay on that talk group and switch frequencies when we get out of range of one, go into the range of the other.
That is called roaming. Yes, exactly. That's exactly how it would work. If you had your radio set up for roaming, it would stay on the talk group that you had everything all programmed into and just bounce from repeater to repeater to repeater that it was in range of on the same talk group, and you would effectively just keep going and not even know.
The only time you'd have a problem is if you have a dead zone in between repeaters in that case.
Remember cell phone coverage? When you didn't have a cell tower every 50 feet, and you would be talking to somebody, and all of a sudden your call would drop because it couldn't find the next cell to connect to?
Same technology, just different frequencies and different equipment.
Exactly. It's exactly how this stuff works.
So is our equipment capable of being set up roaming?
Those HTs are. Motorola's are. The new MD380s, the CS700s, 750s, 800s, all that stuff, no. Hasn't been written into the firmware of those radios yet. Whether it will be, we don't know. But roaming is cool if you have, you know, a need for it. It's not like a necessity, but if you're going in and out of multiple coverage areas, especially like we said with common talk groups, then it would be advantageous to have it so that you don't drop out of the talk groups when you move in and out of repeater coverage ranges.
Okay. When I get my cable later this week, you and I have to make an appointment to install the software, and you got to teach me how to use it.
Software is not hard to use. I mean, you can look at any of the other software that's available for any of the other radios. It's all pretty similar. Just each one has maybe a couple of little choices difference or wording difference or something like that.
Well, you told me certain things don't change, and I don't want to make a mistake and mess up the radio.
It's easy. All you do is, before you do anything, you read the radio and you save what's in the radio. Then, if you screw it up, you just put the original code plug that you read from the radio back into the radio and you're back to where you started from. As long as you only work with a copy and not with the original, you're fine.
Okay.
So were you chatting with anybody over the weekend, doing anything with it, or was it just collecting dust?
Well, I was basically just collecting dust because Friday and Saturday, even though, as I told you, Friday was supposed to be a vacation day, I spent both days at my desk doing paperwork for school.
Wow. Non-billable hours. Non-billable hours. Alright. I believe Saturday mornings, I'm not 100% of the time, I'm pretty sure Saturday mornings there is a net on worldwide that obviously is a worldwide net. It's just basically, I guess, a check-in. I don't really know if they pass any real pertinent traffic, but it's like a worldwide net. Everybody checks in and they have something to say. They say something. I believe Eric had turned it on so that it was active on Club Repeater for Saturday morning, but then all that stuff got turned back off again, I think.
Basically, I'm curious, the backbone of this is an internet connection?
Yes. That's how they all connect, over the internet, through a little miracle device called a C-Bridge, which is just a fancy router that does specific routing tasks.
An interface between the radio and the cable.
The repeater itself has the ability to connect over IP. You can connect up regular, let's say, you know, you had a business, and your business had multiple locations, maybe like on a campus, okay? Like on a campus. But the campus was too big to cover radio communications from one end to the other. You could have a repeater at each end of the campus, and they just connect to each other through your internet or your intranet on campus. And then it's the same thing. You can go back and forth between the two repeaters. The C-Bridge expands that to larger geographical areas.
Okay. The interrelationship between computer networks and radio gear.
Slowly, just like we've been playing with all along with Echolink and IRLP and all these other things, just taking it to the next level.
All right. So how far along are you?
Crawling through a four-laner, of course.
I'm up to the repeater site now.
All right. So you're getting there.
Everyone's keeping their speed down because of the weather.
Rightfully so, because none of these people know how to drive when it rains.
Anyway, so, how was your weekend? I told you what I did 90% of the time.
Saturday, I was out in the backyard building planter boxes. Scrap wood that my neighbor ripped up from a deck he was replacing. So got rid of the old plastic like window boxes on that we had on the deck, and I built new ones out of wood.
Did you put water weep holes in the bottom?
Yes, the design is for pass-through drainage, not a problem. And they're all also hooked up to drip irrigation so that they get watered every day, twice a day, when the sprinklers come on. I have drip irrigation on all my stuff, all my hanging baskets, my fruits and vegetables, herbs, everything. All drip irrigation.
Do you have exotic herbs?
You know, those Colombian tomato plants, they need a lot of water.
Okay. So you're doing hydroponic gardening?
No. Drip irrigation. Hydroponics is soilless. That's how I started my tomato plants over the winter. I've got Campari tomatoes I'm growing, and those were all started indoors over the winter, and when I brought the plants out, then I put them in the dirt.
Okay. See, I'm not a big veggie eater, so I don't get into that stuff.
Doesn't make you a bad person. And to be being mobile. But the herbs and stuff also turn around and, you know, make sure they get watered when everything else gets watered. Plus, I'm doing some tropicals. I've got some cannas that I'm growing, and I've got a couple of banana plants. I got a banana plant from one of my friends that came up from Puerto Rico, so I've got babies. So I gotta nurture the babies to make sure that the babies live and thrive and grow tall.
What's gonna happen with those baby banana plants over the winter? They're gonna survive?
Yes, they come inside and they go in my back room. That's all. That's what I did with the cannas over the winter. And the cannas came out and they were already pretty tall. So when they came outside, so same thing will happen with the bananas.
Okay. Oh, by the way, a rubber band around the base of the microphone connection works wonderfully.
Oh, for the little door.
Easy, your.
I have to remember that. Mine's sitting at home right now. Left it in the charger. I was busy adding more and more contacts to the contact list on the program, but I didn't bother writing it to the radio because every day it seems another half dozen people from the club get their IDs.
The advantage to having the contact list in the radio is only that it'll come up with the name and the call sign, not just the ID number, correct?
That's right. It's a comparative database. If it doesn't have an entry to match the ID number, it'll just come up with the ID number. If it has a match, it displays whatever you put in for the match.
But you can still talk, no problem.
Hey, not a problem at all. It'll just show a number. And then what you do is you remember that number, and you can manually enter it into the radio, so that the next time that number comes up, you'll have whatever it is that you just entered into the radio. That you can input.
Does the software allow you to program in listen only, monitor only frequencies?